Welcome to the Abhijit Chavda podcast. Today's guest is a very special guest who has been on the podcast before. It's Belinda Chakarova. She is a geopolitical analyst. She's the founder of FACE for a Conscious Experience, which is a geopolitical consulting company that provides expert analysis and solutions for the most relevant geopolitical risks, trends, and scenarios that may affect businesses or institutions. And she is the former director of the Austrian Institute of for European and Security Policy, AIES, which is located in Vienna, Austria. And all her social media and other relevant links can be found in the description below. And I would recommend that you subscribe to her excellent newsletter. So, Belinda, thank you very much for being on the podcast again, and welcome.
Thank you, Abhijit. It's a great pleasure to be back to this wonderful conversation, because I hope that it's not going to be a monologue, but it will be a conversation between the two of us, as you can have plenty of opinions and, you know, your own expertise on the topics that we will be covering.
Right. So we spoke about 3 weeks ago last month, and we covered a lot of topics. And one of the things we discussed afterwards was that it's very important for people who live in different parts of the world to listen to each other and hear each other's perspective, so that we don't get focused on only one viewpoint of the world. So that's why it's very interesting to talk to you, because you provide a very different viewpoint as to what we have in India. And it's very important for Indian audiences to be exposed to the European perspective, for instance, because we kind of tend to see the West as a monolithic entity with the US and Western Europe together. But it's definitely different. So let's begin with what's, there are so many things happening in the world. The geopolitical chessboard is very rapidly realigning itself. But let's begin with the most hottest topic, let's say the Ukraine war. It's been 1 year of the Ukraine war. So I would like to see how you read the situation. Do you see Russia as winning, or do you see Russia as losing? What do you think is happening right now?
Of course, I would start with, first and foremost, the realities, the military realities on the ground. We have a situation not seen and witnessed since the end of the Second World War in terms of the scope and the repercussions. So we have, of course, a war that is being conducted as it was the case during the First World War, during the Second World War, with all the available military means on both sides. So it's really devastating if you take a look at not just the casualties in terms of what is happening in the battles between the soldiers, but also when it comes to the civilian casualties, the displaced persons, and those who have fled the country. Meanwhile, I think around 14 million out of 44 million Ukrainians have, been displaced and fled the country. So it's devastating in all dimensions of the war. It's a real full-fledged, war that has been more or less, let's say, hasn't been foreseen by with few exceptions, mostly from the circles of military experts, mostly in the United States, because they obviously have more, more available intelligence and the access to, obviously to more reliable information when it comes to the military analysis. But this war hasn't been foreseen by the majority of political decision makers, by the majority of security geopolitical experts. I have been, part of those who have been pointing to the highest possibility of a war, but as it was described at the very beginning, as a limited military operation, only in the south and the east of the country. And obviously, I was also wrong when it came to the scope and the dimensions of this full-fledged war. Now, 400 plus days, fast forward, and we are currently in the scenario where Ukraine is preparing for the next military counteroffensive. It's coming, most likely In April, and now we are in a situation where the leaks of the Pentagon documents have exposed a lot of the military plans, weapon systems, a lot of information that is damaging to the preparations of this, you know, counteroffensives. And in a sense, we may see a kind of delay, maybe also some sort of shift in the military plans. But the counteroffensive is coming. When it comes to the Russian, plans, because you also asked, is Russia winning? Is Ukraine winning? We are currently in this limbo situation. It's a war of attrition. Some say it could, go on like that for the next 3-5 years. Some say even for the next 20 years. I've heard a lot of different opinions. There is no scenario in which we will see the end of the war of attrition by 2023. What we would probably see, and it will very much depend on what is going to happen in the next, let's say, 3 to 6 months, is a kind of situation where probably a first round of talks, I wouldn't say negotiations, maybe some kind of negotiation ceasefire will be pushed by the external actors that are involved in this war as well. I mean, think of the United States, but also think of China. So on both sides, there will be more pressure. United States obviously preparing for the next election campaign. And since we've learned from yesterday that Joe Biden is going to run for the presidency again, November, I think, is the timeline, at least my personal timeline, where we will see a kind of pressure coming from outside. Also on behalf of China, we've already seen that, even though that I don't think that these intentions are authentic, but still we have a 12-point plan, so China will be also pushing a little bit on the global arena. So Russia has started its military offensive at the end of January, beginning of February. Nothing significant moved so far. Here we have two scenarios. Either Russia is hiding its, true intention. So we are about to see the real scope of this offensive, depending on, of course, on the counteroffensive by the Ukrainian troops. Or if the second scenario is the correct one, maybe these are the limitations of the Russian troops, as some have been anticipating, which is why this offensive hasn't, been fruitful so far. To wrap it up, a lot will be decided in this phase of the war of attrition in the next, 3 to 6 months. And then we will see a lot of external pressure, but also, I suppose, internal pressure, because Russia is also preparing for election campaign. Starting with November, the presidential election has been set for the 17th of March next year, and Putin wants to be reelected.
Yes, that's interesting. Russia is also entering this phase of elections. Do you see Vladimir Putin being re-elected? And if he is indeed re-elected, how long do you see him ruling the country?
Well, I obviously see his readiness to be re-elected. So he really, really wants to remain in power. And so far, there are no indications whatsoever, no inner political and nor external indications that, current situation is endangered, that he would not be able to run for the presidency. I think that Russia has accommodated with the scenario of long war, of a war of attrition, after failing to achieve its goals in the first phase of the war in March, April last year. And it quickly accommodated with this reality that it won't be possible for the Russian troops and for the Russian strategy to achieve what it was, meant to be achieved. Now, we can, of course, discuss whether you know, in military terms, it was achievable at all, what, you know, was what was the original plan. But anyway, I mean, Russia is in the right now in the situation of a new mass mobilization. It has the capacities to, you know, further amass troops. Now, one could argue, of course, that these troops, you know, badly prepared, with no time for training or whatsoever, will be used as a cannon fodder to stabilize the front lines. We can all argue about it. So what we know so far is that, and I think that this was also signaled during the visit of Xi Jinping to Moscow, where Xi Jinping actually implied that that as a kind of a success, inner political success, which is very typical for this kind of, you know, regimes and governmental forms to back each other, where he implied that Putin is enjoying, you know, kind of popularity, and he's, you know, preparing for the next round. So obviously, a lot is at stake. Here the question is, of course, will the concrete development in this war as of today, as of the next months, affect the election outcome? And I would argue that the Russians have actually supported the war. So despite some protests, I would argue that they have more or less, I mean, the majority is behind Putin in this war, even when he actually made these statements about the great, you know, intentions of previous, you know, Russian rulers, rulers when it comes to bringing back territories that are ours, to use a quote, right? So these are populist, you know, statements that are, you know, welcome in the Russian population, in, you know, in the general Russian population. So in a sense, even let's assume that the counteroffensive by the Ukrainian troops would be successful, even in this scenario, I don't see a direct threat to Vladimir Putin, so long as he can rely on external support. And he gets plenty of this external support, not only from China, but also from India, from many countries in the global south. So he managed actually to, you know, secure this political backing ahead of the war. So he did his homework, so to say, in geopolitical terms. The big question mark here is, of course, how the state will perform. Will the economic, you know, and the economic system be able to absorb all the negative effects from the sanctions? We know for a fact that sanctions always need time, but we also know, meanwhile, that Russia has plenty of, you know, networks and friends that can help bypass sanctions. So at the end, it's going to be about the interplay between all of these variables, you know, the economic variables, the mostly actually geoeconomic variables that help Russia, you know, reduce the international isolation, keep the political system and the economic system afloat. And then, of course, the interplay in terms of military victories, military developments. But as of now, I wouldn't say that he's really, his, you know, position is really in danger. There are no such signs. And I actually argued that, or at least let's say I belong to those experts who think that Putin is actually just the facade of a system that has taken the decision on this full, you know, scale war. And so long as he's actually, you know, propagating this very same goal, he is safe, more or less. But it could become critical if the system, you know, sees itself endangered. So it could become critical for him in a sense that if the system sees the necessity to remove him in order to preserve itself. This is, I think, a scenario that is also not impossible, maybe rather in the longer term.
Very interesting. So you're implying the possibility that there exists a Russian deep state in Russia, which is
absolutely, absolutely, yes, absolutely. Yeah, I apply that, and absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. I mean, the very fact that we cannot prove, you know, the very existence of this so-called, I mean, you can call it deep state, you could call it a reminiscence of what has been so efficient for such a long time, I mean, for decades in the Soviet system, you know, to have a system of intelligence services that could, you know, provide a complete, let's say, societal subjugation. And in fact, I mean, think a little bit of the technological advantages nowadays. How China, for instance, is able to create the similar effects for its system. I mean, the Chinese Communist Party, not China itself, but the Chinese Communist Party can use these technological advantages. You know, think of the social credit system, for instance. And now imagine that there was a similar Communist Party that was able to do that with its own population without any technological advantages. I mean, you can imagine the potential and the abilities and the capabilities actually of such system to do that successfully over decades, as I said, and to do that abroad as well as at home. So I argue that this system remained intact following the collapse of the Soviet Union and could, you know, redefine itself, and then could penetrate the society of Russia, the political system, the industries, the economic infrastructure, and it's practically the skeleton of Russian, of the Russian Federation. The second important element that remained intact following the collapse of the Soviet Union has been so-called Comintern. I mean, the networks, the global networks of the Communist Party. You should never make the mistake to think that the Communist Party is only a national phenomenon. And that has never been the case and will never be the case. And that the revolution is just a national phenomenon. So, I mean, the very idea of the Communist Party to actually, bring about change through revolution, by revolutionizing the masses, right? This has always been an international project and will remain such.
Okay. Let's talk about Europe. So Europe has been definitely impacted and affected by the war and the sanctions and the complete realignment that we're witnessing. And recently, Monsieur Macron of France, he visited China. And so what do you think were Mr. Macron's objectives in his visit to China? And do you think this visit was successful?
Okay, I will start with the easier part of your question, so which is the assessment whether successful or not successful. Of course, we have to wait and see how successful this visit will be. But as my job is also to give an assessment and an anticipation, I would actually argue that such visit cannot be successful given the statements and given, the agenda, even given the scope of the delegation. If you take a look what kind of delegation went to Beijing, you know, all of this actually points to a rather scenario that is destined to fail. And I will explain why. Now, first and foremost, he actually took the president of the European Commission on this journey. So the idea was, and this is not a new idea, we know for a fact that we had a previous leadership between France and Germany, where both went together with the president of the European Commission to Beijing to show actually a coherent European approach when dealing with China. And this was, when it comes to the optics, it's a good idea to show that you have, of course, the biggest player in terms of, global trade. And that is obviously the Commission, because the Commission is the executive body of the European Union that signs, that negotiates and signs the trade treaties with third countries. Like, for instance, in the case of China, this was the negotiated comprehensive agreement on investment that was, negotiated and then signed during Chancellor Merkel's mandate. And then it was put on hold by the European Parliament just a month later because of the violation of human rights, labor rights. Then, sanctioning on both sides followed by China, by putting, parliamentarians, European parliamentarians on a sanctions list, together also with some colleagues from the think tank landscape here in Europe, and so on and so forth. So obviously, nothing really moved in the period during the pandemic. And we, of course, know that the pandemic was, in a sense, an eye-opener when it comes to, China, where certain member states, started looking at certain policies coming from China with different eyes. Okay, but then again, what we have at the core of the so-called European approach is, of course, the role of France and Germany, this, Franco-German engine of the European integration, right? When it comes to the role of member states, out of the 27, we can axiomatically accept that the Franco-German engine following Brexit is at the core of European policies. And now when it comes, of course, to the policies with external powers, obviously, it's important what France says or what Germany does. And what happened? First, immediately following the 20th Congress of the Communist Party last year in October in China, the German chancellor went solo to a state visit. So on a state visit to China. This was, of course, a very bad signal and in itself tells you a lot about, certain, dichotomy in this so-called Franco-German engine, where we know for a fact that there is no bromance between Scholz and Macron and that there is no chemistry between these two personalities, between these two leaders. And this, of course, affects the whole bilateral and the European, in general, the European approach. So coming back to the France's role, on the one hand, you take the president of the European Commission with you and you go together. But then again, if you take a look at the pictures, just, Google and see a little bit about, what the coverage was. And you see everywhere Macron. You see Macron with Xi Jinping. You see Macron visiting students. So the optics tells you a very different story, that it is really about the personality first. And then what really was, I think, the worst moment of this visit was this interview that he gave for a French, media, which was also then translated by Politico. Politico is very famous here in Europe, and it created waves and waves and waves of misunderstanding and of reaction. And here, practically, what it's about is that, more or less, the positions of the French president, which are French positions, and probably I would even argue more or less personal positions. We know that he has always had this visionary, views about the future of Europe and about the position of Europe in the world. So here he made some really, really awkward statements, such as the one that Europe should reduce its dependence on the United Nations, United States, in order to avoid being dragged into a confrontation between China and the United States, specifically over a topic, and the topic was Taiwan. So here we saw actually a clear messaging that I argue was, on the one hand, bad messaging towards the European states, and certainly not a message where you will find all European states on the same page. And second, of course, bad messaging towards China, giving, so to say, a green light, more or less, to China for its actions against Taiwan in the future. Right? We don't want to get caught in a binary world. We don't want to get caught in a systemic conflict. We will, We will deal with both and practically want to be left alone, which was a very, very bad messaging in my personal view. This is my personal assessment. So what is the reading out of it? First, and I've been arguing that for months, that what we are seeing right now is a kind of a bifurcation, splitting of Europe in two major blocks based on the approach of the European states to Russia in the short term and to China in the long term. And we find actually, and this is very interesting, France and Germany in the same block when it comes to their approach to Russia. Think of all the, you know, negotiations, talks, and so on and so forth ahead of the war. Think of the geopolitical rapprochement these countries had with Russia. In fact, they wanted to normalize and deepen the relations with Russia before the war began. And even when the war began, they were still, you know, trying to somehow accommodate with Russia. And think also of their approach to China, where they basically tell you know, United States, they are not going to support the American position if China decides to militarily attack Taiwan. And then again, there is another block of countries, mostly in the north, in central, in Eastern European, you know, parts of Europe, which actually are, well, have detrimentally opposed positions to both Russia and China. So we saw how the Baltic states left, you know, China's initiative, which meanwhile is no longer 17 plus one, but is 14 plus one. And we also saw that they were the countries that started supporting, you know, Ukraine, not in 2022, but even after the first invasion. These were the countries that were telling, you know, France and Germany, which negotiated, you know, the Minsk agreements that that practically this is just a break and that Russia would strike again and so on and so forth. So this bifurcation of Europe is being manifested right now. And the approach of France and Germany, I argue, will further trigger it and amplify it because of exactly these policies.
So I have always seen the United States as kind of the leader of Western Europe because it's definitely leading the NATO alliance and it's also in some way involved in the European Union. So how do you think the United States will approach this so to say rebellion by Germany and France? I mean, if they are essentially openly saying that they want to distance themselves from the United States and they will not condemn a possible Chinese invasion of Taiwan. How do you think the United States will or should approach this problem?
Well, these are two different issues, how the United States would act and what the United States should do, right? So because the one entails political recommendations, the other one is more or less an anticipation for the future. Allow me to start with the anticipation for the future. First and foremost, I argue that Russia has decided to make a move on Ukraine, also not necessarily exclusively, but also based on its assessment, its geopolitical assessment for the future American role on the old continent. I mean, given what happened in Afghanistan, given the slow withdrawal from the Middle East, what is now called West Asia, mostly, you know, by Asian states, there was this anticipation that United States is no longer interested in staying on the old continent, and the big focus would be the Indo-Pacific region, not only the Strait of Taiwan, not only South China Sea, but the whole Indo-Pacific region with all the partners, allies there. And of course, this would entail the hardest, let's say, work for the Americans to forge these new partnerships, to invest in these alliances, and to prepare for the big confrontation with China. And I argue that because of this assessment of the Russians, we saw this full-scale war now that more or less, I think the geoeconomic environment was the most favorable for you know, the Russian interests. Think of the commodities prices ahead of the war. War is always you know, inflationary. So there were very positive conditions to do so. But in a sense, I find these statements specifically coming from Macron. And it is not the first time that he is so sensationalist and he's making this kind of very, very awkward statements. Not really, I mean, I find it hard to understand them, because what he also said in Beijing was that the great risk, and I quote, is getting caught up in crises that are not ours.
Yeah.
And here, of course, the main idea is that to ask is, was the crisis, I mean, the crisis is, of course, a very, very weak word to use, but was the crisis that happened in Europe actually the crisis for the Americans to take care of? I argue not. Because the message coming from Washington to Moscow was very, very clear that there was zero interest to get militarily involved in a possible military conflict on the old continent, because of, as I said, this reshifting of the focus, which I also think that was a kind of, let's say, part, a component of the interplay of variables that led to the decision, you know, to make a move on Ukraine on behalf of Russia. But in a sense, to claim that, you know, United States is obliged to take care of this crisis, this is the worst crisis ever. If we stay with the word crisis, this is by far the worst crisis Europe is facing. And to claim that the United States should be obliged to take care of this crisis, and let's be honest, Ukraine would have collapsed and it would have capitulated, actually, if it had not been for the Americans. So if Ukraine had relied on France and Germany at the beginning of the war, Ukraine would have collapsed and would have capitulated. So at the very same time, to claim that, you know, crises of that, you know, involve and affect our strategic ally are not ours to take care of is I would say not really the way how you should actually treat your allies. In a sense, it is a little bit of a message such as, you know, you want to have the cake and eat it, right? You want to have the security umbrella, you want to have the benefits of someone else's security umbrella, while you can still invest most of your means in welfare, in the welfare system. You know, you don't need to take care of your own defense, you don't need to take care of your own vicinity. Practically, this is, I think, very ingenuine message. It's very confusing, and in a sense, this is also to some extent the reason why it creates such waves of bifurcation, such confusion, because some countries in Europe are still looking at the United States as the sole guarantor of their security, of their territorial integrity. When the Soviet Union collapsed in the 90s, first, it wasn't first and foremost about joining the European Union. It wasn't first and foremost about the European integration. It wasn't first and foremost about the economy. It was first and foremost about security guarantees. Security guarantees to not get attacked by Russia. So once again, I think that, here we have a clear dichotomy of understanding, you know, because on the one hand, there is this claim that there can be a European strategic autonomy. That means that Europe could act on its own. And this is wrong perception. And it is, in a sense, a kind of geopolitical lie. Why? Because we don't have not only the military muscle to prevent a war from happening on our own territory, on the old continent, but we don't even have, you know, the means in technological terms, in industrial terms, to become such, you know, superpower as Macron was claiming. For all this ambition, for all these ambitious, let's say, plans in all these various sectors, amid a fourth industrial revolution, in which actually there are mostly two competitors right now. And once again, this is United States and China. I don't see how Europe would manage, you know, to catch up with these two systemic rivals, to become on par with them in terms of military power projection, even in its own direct vicinity. So it's ingenuine, in a sense, also what we saw with Russia's war against Ukraine is the revitalization of the idea that the only way how you can provide for your territorial integrity here in Europe is in fact through a defense alliance, which is NATO. So practically one of the main narratives that you know, Putin was using right from the beginning, where he said, in fact, in his first TV, live, he said practically that he launched this special military operation, in his words, to prevent NATO expansion. But what we saw in return is exactly the opposite effect. We saw that NATO continued enlarge, you know, the enlargement, because there were more countries, and in fact neutral countries such as Finland and Sweden, countries that were neutral and non-aligned for the last 60 respectively 250 years, that they actually decided to join NATO because this was the only way for them to provide for their territorial integrity and security. So once again, we see that even from that perspective, the role of the United States and the fear that the United States actually will withdraw from the old continent is becoming bigger and bigger. So the only way how to keep it, you know, involved is via NATO. Through the alliance. So here the anticipation is that it was, in fact, it was not in the American interest, as many argue. Actually, many argue that the Americans were interested in this war. They were preparing this. You know, the Russian main narrative is that this is a war between NATO and Russia. But I argue that, in fact, Russia, United States have been losing interest in the old continent. And once there was this ultimate decision by Moscow to launch a full-scale war, the fear of America to get involved in a two-front scenario, to suddenly face a scenario in which Washington will have to deal with both Russia and China on two completely different fronts, became so big that they decided that the only way forward is to support Ukraine by all means, in order to help Ukraine actually sustain the Russian military attacks, and by doing so to weaken the Russian state. When it comes to the question, what should, you know, United States do? This is a very, very different story, because here I argue that this dividing line, this invisible dividing line between European NATO members, is going to grow bigger and bigger. And probably one way how to avoid it, because it's not in the American interest, of course, to have such a dividing line in the transatlantic community. At the same time, because Washington will be increasingly eyeing its partners and allies in the Indo-Pacific region, it automatically means that it's going to lose interest in its European allies. Here, I argued that maybe one way how to, you know, proceed, how to maybe avoid this dividing line from getting deeper and deeper, is via institutional cooperation with, let's say, with European institutions. Like, what we are going to see is this enhanced institutional cooperation between the European Union and NATO to keep track of of let's say a bilateral track instead of, you know, bilateral relations between United States on the one hand and certain European states on the other hand, which we are also going to observe, by the way. There will be a bilateralization of the international relations. It's unavoidable trend. But here, at least through the institutional approach, if there would be another Trump in the future, it could be probably avoided to have a certain, you know, cutoff of the cooperation.
So you mentioned the prospect that the United States could face a two-front kind of conflict, one in Eastern Europe and one in Taiwan. Do you see the possibility of the Chinese invading Taiwan anytime soon? If yes, when do you see it happening?
No, I don't see such a scenario. I think that such a scenario has very low probability. I think that what China would be doing, the Chinese Communist Party would decide to do, I mean, the leadership around Xi Jinping, is to apply what I call a death by thousand cuts approach. That means creeping political, economic, and societal subjugation of Taiwan. There will be destroying the economic vitality as a model. There will be penetrating the political system, will be investing in actors on the ground to, let's say, follow Chinese-friendly policies, to sabotage, of course, the democratic principles, to show that the model of democracy, Asian democracy, is not functioning. Then you have, of course, a lot of possibilities how to infiltrate the social fabric, something that there is a whole playbook for that. And given the experience, and I would say successful experience from the past, they would be going for this scenario, of course, if there is a, let's say, sudden risk of deterioration of the relations between United States and China, if Xi Jinping is pushed in the corner to act and to show military muscle. I mean, I wouldn't exclude that this could happen, but it would happen under really unexpected circumstances. And rather than risking so much, and they have been carefully observing the risks and the negative effects coming out of the, you know, of Russia's war against Ukraine. So instead of risking so much, they will be going for a safer path, and this would be, you know, to invest slowly but surely in this, as I said, approach. Because if you have so many cuts over time, you know, the victim doesn't notice, but is being, you know, bled out, so to say, and you have a certain outcome out of this. So one beautiful day, we will wake up to new realities, let's put it that way, where there will be announced that Taiwan is now part of, you know, China, finally part of China, and it is happening on a free base. But this process, of course, will take a lot of time. You will start hearing a lot of messaging, former political figures making these awkward statements. At the beginning, you will think this is very awkward, but, you know, once you get the critical mass, this is very dangerous, because then there is no point of return. And I think that they will be going for this. So in the short term, let's say 2 to 3 years, I don't see really military attack by China on Taiwan. What I will be actually anticipating is that this kind of military buildup is going to increase. We've seen this starting with Pelosi's visit. Now we are in the second phase. Every time, you know, when there is a new, and this is inevitable to happen, because the Americans will have to show more support, more military, more political, economic support. So it's inevitable to happen. It's a kind of a spiral of escalation, but it will be kept under the threshold of a kinetic exchange.
What lessons do you think the Chinese have learned from the Russia-Ukraine conflict?
First, let me start with the fact that probably the most studied topic in China has been and remains the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Okay.
That tells you already the story of how to preserve the Communist Party. You know, the system is more important. We know how collectivist societies function. The system is more important than the individual. Second, now I would not argue that China knew about the upcoming war. I would argue that at the summit between Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping on 4th of February 2022, maybe the Russian president implied that something will happen, in a sense that Russia will take care of its problems in eastern Ukraine, because parts of eastern Ukraine were already under military occupation by Russian troops. And in fact, this was possible only through direct military, financial, economic facilitation coming from Russia. I mean, let's be clear about it. And this has been going on for the last 8 years. So in a sense, I think that maybe there was implied that something would happen, in a sense that they would take care of this issue. But I think lessons learned is also how unpredictable this kind of military operations are, in a sense that I think this is one of the messages which now will be also useful for Chinese decision on Taiwan, to not militarily attack Taiwan, because Taiwan is obviously in a very different geographic location with very different geographic specifics. Here, this actually increases the risks. So there will be even more risks linked to such a military attack. Also, I think that, and this is, of course, my personal assessment, I've been arguing that, in fact, there has been this systemic dimension in the decision-making in Russia, that Putin, in fact, sought to amplify the systemic conflict between China and United States by making a move on Ukraine. He practically confronted China with an impossible situation. Why? Because on the one hand, China could have sticked, to the Western position, could have said, okay, we are going to, stick to the sanctions, we are going to, do what is the general, let's say, position, or use the unique opportunity to actually help Russia keep the West, that means Americans and Europeans, busy on the old continent. This is good news for China. This means that so long as the Americans are actually kept on the old continent, it gives space and it gives time for China to prepare accordingly. And here, in a sense, I think that this was unexpected, but in a sense, it gave China unique positioning, where on the one hand, Russia sided with China, and this is my main argument, in advance. So it sided with China in ahead of this, whole developments, knowing that it would increase the leverage of Moscow and would position Russia, much ahead of the crowd of other regional actors in this newly emerging systemic conflicts, conflict between United States and China. Of course, based on the thesis that Russia would be successful against Ukraine. We are still, not in this scenario. But at the very same time, from China's perspective, it also showed that there is no space, no more space to, not reveal your true intentions. I think that the time of China being very, ambiguous about its role in the global affairs, it's over. And in fact, China had to side with Russia in order to avoid a three-front scenario, in a scenario in which it will have to deal with Taiwan, with the military buildup in Taiwan. It will have to deal with India, because the tensions with India are unavoidable. I mean, there is such thing as envy between nations as well, not only between persons. Seeing that India is on the rise demographically, economically, benefiting from the global supply chains reconfigurations, and at the same time struggling at home economically, demographically, there is it's unavoidable to happen. So these kind of tensions will increase. And then at the same time, having security vacuum in the north was, I think, an absolute, this was an understanding, was an absolute and remains an absolute, you know, no-go. So in a sense, I argue that this kind of, you know, situation confronted the Chinese leadership with absolutely new realities in which they can no longer hide their true face, the face of a, you know, power that has ambitions, that wants to convert its true economic clout into something much bigger, be it regional, or maybe why not even global power projection. And the lesson learned here is you need military exposures, you need military muscle, and you need boots on the ground. And I don't think that they have solved this issue yet. But the very fact that they went for the, you know, military tension with India last year, that they went for the military buildup with Taiwan, and that they are now even considering, because I don't think that the Americans are lying us with these intelligence reports. I'm really convinced that at some point of time, we may see a situation in which Russia will ask for military aid if the stakes are so high, right? And so the moment when China is confronted with this, there will be two options. Either China decides in favor of Russia and provides, not necessarily overtly, but there are ways to find out. You cannot hide, you know, you cannot hide tanks or military equipment. Nowadays, you can see it from everywhere, and most of the information comes from open source companies, not from spying or intelligence reports. But the moment when China decides to provide more to Russia, this war will turn into a proxy war where Russia will officially lose its global power standing, will still be a relevant regional player, but will lose its global power standing. And then you have, of course, a proxy war between two, let's say, smaller countries in terms of power projection that are being supported by the two systemic rivals.
Indeed. So China has been making other moves as well. So recently we had the Saudi Arabia-Iran rapprochement, and both nations gave credit to China for brokering this. So how does this development change the geopolitical, geostrategic chessboard? There is an attempt to move away to some extent from the US dollar. So is this even possible? So how do you see this scenario?
What we see currently are two layers of the global system. So we were discussing right now the game between the top players, the first tier, right? First tier players at the top of the system, if we are looking at it from a helicopter. Now we are going, we are moving one layer lower, where we have all these regional players, plenty of them. And this is where this, kind of misperception has emerged about multipolarity, because we have so many relevant regional players with certain power projection, with certain, you know, role in global affairs that are hedging. They are hedging against both United States and China. They don't want to, on the one hand, they don't want to get caught in a binary world, to choose between two binary options, because they know if they side with the Americans, the access to China will be more or less cut off. And the same goes for China. If they go along with China, then, you know, you don't have the cooperation opportunities with the United States. Most of these countries are currently successfully hedging. Some, like we saw, for instance, with the case of Australia, they took an ultimate decision, this decision to enter AUKUS. AUKUS is not just a deal about submarines. Let's be real about it. This is a security and defense pact And here the main question is, and if my thesis is correct about the bifurcation of the world, I mean that the world is split, being split into two major parts centered around these two centrifugal forces coming from Washington and Beijing, and everything around it, I mean the whole, you know, space in between will be orbiting so long as it is possible. And here you gave a perfect example with the Middle East, with the West Asia, you know, with West Asia. On the one hand, we've been observing a clear vacuum emerging from the fact that the Americans were no longer interested in the region. They became self-sufficient in the energy sector. United States, meanwhile, one of the you know, the key exporters in both oil and gas. And there was no, you know, no existential interest for the Americans to be on the ground. Of course, they had their networks and everything, but we saw this process slowly happening already, you know, 10, 15 years ago. It wasn't a sudden process, but it was happening. And of course, the moment when there is a vacuum, there are always candidates to fill this vacuum. So we saw how China successfully became a trade partner of many of not just, you know, Middle East, but of many corners of the world, replacing United States from the first spot. And then what we saw is that China being exporter, you know, importer number one of energy commodities, has of course become also, has become the biggest client in the region. So here what we are observing is about opportunities. This deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia was not brokered just by China. It was brokered also by Russia, being behind. I mean, having all these diplomatic networks, working with the Iranians, if, you know, even though that some may argue, I mean, they are some kind of regional rivals when it comes to energy deals. Yes and no, because at the same time, they are the very same thing we could argue about Turkey and Russia being rivals, regional rivals, and at the very same time, they are concretely in a geopolitical rapprochement. This is something that is usual and normal to happen in this world of realpolitik. So the Russians were working with the Iranians, you know, to convince them to normalize relations with the Saudis, because for both, for Iran and Saudi Arabia, China is a huge opportunity. And China needs stability in the region. Russia also needs stability in the region because it can actually, it has boots on the ground, it has military presence, and right now it is challenged somewhere else, so it cannot afford itself to have, you know, exposure in another region. So in a sense, it was a merger of interests for both, of course, for Iran and for Saudi Arabia. This was a great opportunity for different reasons. From Iranian point of view, because of the failed JCPOA, because of, you know, the big rivalry with the United States, this was a great opportunity to actually hedge with the biggest competitor. For Saudi Arabia, it was actually to create more pressure on the American leadership because of the missing interest. And here we are going to observe a whole chain of events. So it's not only because we are seeing the umbrella of Iran-Saudi Arabia deal, but what we are going to see are chain of events, considering Syria, considering Yemen, considering Lebanon. So we are going to see a lot of additional negotiations and agreements, which is good for the for the region. In fact, this actually is a good news for the Middle East. It would create more stability. It will pressure all, put pressure on all of them to get along, and we will see a normalization between neighbors that has been unthinkable for decades, such as the case with Israel and Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia and Turkey. I mean, this will be, this will create a lot of opportunities. And at the same time, of course, we should still remain cautious that this kind of deals and this kind of agreements are of temporary nature, such as it is the case also with, Russia, China, the Dragon Bear, or all of the rest. I mean, everything is right now in a kind of a temporary situation because of the transitionary period of the international relations. And we have to wait and see in which kind of direction the international order will go, which will settle all of these relations.
So it's very interesting that the kind of the withdrawal of the United States from the Middle East is leading to the stabilization of the region, and it is good news for the region. That's very interesting. You spoke about various nations that are hedging their bets vis-a-vis the United States and China. How do you see India's approach? So from how I see is India is kind of treading a middle path. It's kind of equidistant from both sides. Is, in your perception, is India also in a way hedging its bets? And is this sustainable? I mean, the US approach has always been that you're either with us or against us. But India is, approaching this on an issue-by-issue basis. So how do you see India's, what do you see India's strategic interests as being? And how long do you think this approach can last?
Now you are putting an European into the impossible situation to make myself to challenge myself, obviously, to give a recommendation to India, knowing that your sessions are mostly viewed and listened to by Indians. But I will make the effort anyway. So first, I don't make a secret out of it that I'm quite bullish on India for several reasons. And here, of course, you mentioned the keyword equidistance. And I had to somehow smile about it because this is now the main narrative coming from Europe, that Europe wants equidistance. But it's one thing to want things and other things to be able to afford things. And I think that the major difference between European equidistance between China and the United States and the Indian equidistance is that the Indian will be a real one based on military muscle, economic performance, and demographic realities. If you compare these two, third superpowers, as Macron was claiming, you know, the third superpower, that should be Europe, which is really an ambition, but is more or less confronted by the reality. India, if it makes things right, has all the chances, all the, you know, the numbers are speaking a clear language. And yet, of course, in the world of realpolitik, there is always also uncertainty. So if things work out for India, India has all the good cards to become this, let's say, third superpower. In economic terms, it has been already projected to become the third world's economic power. It has already the fastest economic growth. It has the ambitions. It has the numbers in terms of demographic changes. China has already peaked demographically, but India is going to grow further. It has the population. It's a young, dynamic population. But once again, there are social structural issues that India has to deal with on its own. This is an Indian issue. This is not an issue to be, you know, this, I mean, it can be discussed by external experts, but I argue that this is something that Indians have to settle for themselves. How to, you know, increase productivity, how to enable large parts of the population to participate in this economic, you know, wonder. Then if we are to talk about the fourth industrial revolution, I mentioned we have two competitors, two front runners. But if you take a look at the corner, who is hiding there? It's India. India has the potential in this specific industrial revolution to make a difference. And I argue that neither the United States nor China will be able to compete on their own. So they will be looking for partners. And here I see a clear pattern of behavior where the Americans will be reaching out. They are already doing this. Will be reaching out to India to help, you know, to mutually help each other to compete with China in the technological domain, in the technological sectors. The chips industry will be coming to India. So the semiconductors, a lot of potential in the in various sectors, defense, space technologies, nanotechnology. So there are so many options when it comes to, you know, the scientific, the technological, the military complex of this, you know, revolution. There will be a lot of opportunities. The military muscle. I mean, once again, you see the clear dichotomy between European ambitions and Indian realities. Whereas on the one hand, you have a war being waged in your direct vicinity, and yet almost 14 months in a war situation, there is no sense of urgency in the European capitals. There is no realization that there is also a non-kinetic war being waged on the European population, which is a normal thing to expect. I mean, of course, the Russian president wants to destroy the security order in Europe, because in a vacuum, in a, let's say, a chaotic situation of concerts of power, of powers in Europe, he would be able to deal with those countries that have Russia-friendly policies. And he will be also able to isolate, to build blocks of countries and isolate those who are strictly and vehemently against Russia. Here in the Indo-Pacific, you have India, which is fighting its wars on its own. It doesn't have much help from outside. Okay, when it comes to the arms exports, it relies on Russia, but the trend is clearly pointing to the new reality, that is that India is going to increasingly make sure to become more self-sufficient via own industry, you know, its own industry, but also via partnerships with other countries. This is the most normal thing to happen: diversification in all relevant sectors and in all sectors that actually entail a critical infrastructure. That is actually the way forward. But once again, when it comes to the military tensions with China, here it's Indian troops fighting Chinese troops. And it's the Indian power projection in the direct vicinity. If tomorrow, let's say, there would be a military buildup in the direct, let's say, in the Indian Ocean, in the direct vicinity of India. Big difference, once again. India has had, has gathered experience also from the participation in the missions of international organizations, such as the United Nations. It has the boots on the ground, and it has shown readiness to fight. So, big difference once again in all this portfolio, from economy and technology to demographics and to military defense capabilities and military readiness. I see a big difference. And if I have to, you know, generalize here, if there would be a one-third superpower to emerge in this decade or in the next decade, this would be India and not Europe. But what could actually be done in this specific, let's say, bilateral track is to use also the relationship between Europe and India, specifically in the trade domain. I mean, to at least agree on a free trade agreement. Europe, as an aging population with a big share of the labor force going, in the next at least 10, 20 years in the scenario of getting retired, we'll need a lot of labor force. And this labor force can come from India. Also, when it comes to the technological revolution, the digitalization, the scientific exchange, there are so many opportunities. Let's say to have also a hedge the Americans, because I don't think that India, in the end, no matter how serious this regional confrontation will become with China, and how serious the decoupling between United States and China will become. India will be cautious to enter a strategic alliance with the United States. So in a sense, to, you know, keep, let's say, the hedge option, there may be also a third way for the relations between Europe and India to create a counterweight to the binary world.
Right. Now, Russia has said that it considers China and India to be its two top strategic partners. It's given out a revised version of its foreign policy document. So we have this organization called BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Now, the biggest fault line within BRICS is the India-China adversarial relationship, but Russia would like both nations to be close to it, and there is talk about RIC, Russia, India, China. So do you see in the future sometime Russia and the RIC kind of thing happening? Russia has, I mean, China has brokered the, or so, I mean, China and Russia together, you can say, have brokered the Saudi Iran rapprochement. Do you think Moscow could possibly in the future broker a China-India rapprochement, and would it be beneficial for them?
Well, Russia has been trying to broker a rapprochement between India and China all the time. I think that it has been the glue that kept, you know, India and China together in all these multilateral formats initiated by China. And I think it was also a smart move, by the way, by New Delhi to be part of them. Why should be isolated from them? And why should actually, you know, allow significant regional formats and institutions and organizations, let's say, to work without your participation, without knowing what's going on there, what's being discussed? I think this was a smart move by India to be part of them, but it was certainly also Russia's role, in a sense that Moscow was convincing enough to, you know, explain how important it is to be part of China-led formats, because being isolated, as it happened with the West, doesn't give you any leverage. You are simply out of all the discussions. Let's not forget that Russia's position, if you take a look at regional wars and confrontations, I mean, think of Azerbaijan-Armenia war, think of the other frozen conflicts. This is the usual positioning of Russia, to be part of, you know, both, to be part of the conflict, to supply both sides with arms, which Russia is doing also with India and with China. It's not only about the S-400, it's also about the arms. Russia has been the largest arms supplier to both India and China. At some point of time in the future, when India has the leverage, the geo-economic and the geopolitical leverage, it will realize that it's good, also it's clever policy, to diversify away, not to cut off. Certainly this is not going to happen, but to diversify, to have hedge options, and to have option B, C, D, which New Delhi is already doing with the participation in Quad, with the whole, you know, formats that the United States has been pushing for in the last few years. This is a good, this is smart policy. This is the way how actually geopolitics is being done. And from Russia's point of view, of course, more collaboration between China and India, being the two major international partners, is good news, but it contradicts the reality. As I said, the reality is that we should axiomatically anticipate more tensions. It does not mean that I wish for India and China to get involved in more military tensions. I don't want to be misunderstood. It's just my anticipation based on the realities how both countries will develop in the future. So less economic development, demographic troubles for China, more economic development, more, you know, demographic, the demographics is also on the side of India. And then, of course, having all these partners, as it is the case with India, whereas China is more or less becoming more and more isolated by certain countries, obviously, this will also create, I think, I mean, it's destined to create more tensions between both countries. So in a sense, these platforms are useful in the short term, and obviously Russia will be trying to keep them as long as possible for both to talk, to mitigate risks, to also, even after the tensions, this was, I think, if I'm not wrong, RIC was the first format where they talked after 2017, after the previous military episode. If I'm not wrong, this was the first format where they met, the leaders of India and China met and talked with each other. But this is a little bit of, you know, wishful thinking. And depending on, once again, on the direction of the global order, is it going to be really about multipolarity? I mean, with India being its own pole, with China being in demise in the next, let's say, 30, 40 years, because even if all these prognoses are correct, that China will have around 600 million people. Okay, we have to see what it means for, you know, for the country, how the country will, you know, establish itself regionally. Still, there is plenty of potential, and in the, let's say, middle term of the next 15 to 20 years, a lot can happen. A lot can happen. So, I think that from Russians' point of view, it's more about wishful thinking, because Russians know that if things get really messy, they will have to take a side. They don't want to take a side between India and China. They want to keep both partnerships. Both partnerships are very important to them for different reasons. At the same time, India wants a more engagement on behalf of Russia in the Indo-Pacific. This has been also announced, that they want to have more actors in the Indo-Pacific because they think that Russia's participation will maybe mitigate a little bit the risks coming out of this bloc formation, you know, this bloc confrontation. We've read it in the joint declaration between China and Russia when they announced AUKUS to be, you know, this unfriendly bloc. So India's position is once again a little bit in between, right? So I think that for now, it will really be about more about hedging, being present, being part of this and that format, and trying to you know, participate, get your positions heard, and communicate your positions. This is a critical year for India, being in charge for G20, and India saw the limitations, right, with the Foreign Minister Summit. By the way, I was in India when it took place, and they were, understandably, they were displeased about the fact that China and Russia practically hindered the joint declaration. So in a sense, it will be waking up to realities that some things are wishful thinking, some things are, you know, possible through back channels and through silent diplomacy. But the portfolio of India will be axiomatically increasing, and dependent on the outcome of Russia's war against Ukraine, we are about to see what kind of portfolio Russia will have. And as and at the same time, China, we can axiomatically anticipate, is going to have more assertive, more nationalistic policy, because now is the time. Now is the time to, like I said, the masks are off, and now is the time to be real about your intentions.
Yes, that's right. Last time we had a discussion, we spoke about World War III, the possibility of World War III. It's something we never want to happen. But I would like to ask you, if there is a World War III, what could be the spark that sets it off? Where could it happen?
I do not belong to those who actually foresee World War III. In fact, I argue that we are already in a Cold War 2.0 scenario. We are already in it. The war by Russia against Ukraine has been the manifestation of it. And as I said, the proxy war, if it turns out to be a proxy war, once China clearly positions itself, including military aid for Moscow, then it is a manifestation also for those who don't want to believe that the key players in the global affairs are not interested in direct military confrontation against each other. Neither United States nor China nor Russia are interested in a direct confrontation against each other. So my main thesis is that we are in a non-military, comprehensive, non-kinetic confrontation between the West on the one hand and the Dragon Bear on the other hand. Now the question, of course, that you ask is what could spark direct confrontation? The use of nuclear weapons. The use of nuclear weapons by Russia, of tactical nuclear weapons by Russia against Ukraine, which, by the way, has zero military meaning. It will not change anything on the ground. But as the nuclear blackmail has been used right from the beginning of this war, and there are still a lot of people who fear, I honestly don't think that there is a real benefit from the use of tactical nuclear weapons. And I think that Putin understands the red line, that this red line has been communicated by both United States and China, by the way. And even though India hasn't communicated it openly, I think that they have communicated it also via their channels. There have been meetings also with the National Security Advisor and so on. I am convinced that it's not in India's interest also to see that conflict is being solved by the use, military conflict is being solved by the use of nuclear weapons. I mean, what would that mean for India, for India-China military tensions? What would that mean for India-Pakistan conflict? So in a sense, this could spark direct military confrontation because the United States will get militarily involved. I mean, the United States as such will send boots on the ground, will get militarily involved in Ukraine if there is use of nuclear weapons. I would say that this probably would be the only scenario in the short term that could spark such World War III. But maybe let's end with some good news. I mean, at least from derived from my assessment and my scenarios, is that I see a low probability of for the use of tactical nuclear weapons. I see low probability for a direct military confrontation. That means World War III. And I see a low probability for China's military attack on Taiwan in the short term.
All right. Well, last question for you. How was your experience in India at the Raisina dialogues? I know that you met Prime Minister Modi briefly. How was that?
Well, that is very personal. I don't think that I would that I'm ready to share this information yet. Maybe let's agree to share it in a year when there is a certain space in between, because we had a personal conversation. I admit, we had a personal conversation. I was invited by Prime Minister Narendra Modi to a short meeting together with four other colleagues, two Australian colleagues, one American colleague, and one South African colleague. And in a sense, I was the only European, and I saw myself actually as a European being invited, not as an Austrian being invited. But I think it was also very personal, so I would like to make a promise that I will share this in a year.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's no need to share any personal conversations. I was just asking, how was the overall experience? Did you enjoy your trip to India? Was it nice?
In fact, I've been three times to three different summits and meetings alone in this year. I attended the top-ranking US-India forum in January as the only European, and I had the big honor and pleasure to be part of these closed door discussions between American and Indian colleagues, not only from think tanks and from institutes, but also from decision making industries and practically a lot of important sectors. Then what I also had the pleasure to attend was the Global Business Summit in February, and there I gave a keynote speech on the Dragon Bear, which, by the way, is available on YouTube. You can find it just by, you know, Googling it. And then I came to Resina, and Resina was the absolute highlight, of course, with thousands of attendants from all over the world. I think that this was by far the most successful Resina forum. And it, in a sense, I think that it also was indicative of India's rising star on the global arena, not only in diplomatic terms, but also currently my assessment is that India is lucky to have a well-prepared leadership. And that does not mean only the top of the decision-making, prime minister and his team, but also the cabinet ministers, because you need a lot of decision-making also when it comes to the sectors. As I said, a lot of changes are happening right now, and you can ride the, you know, the wave of this industrial revolution if you're well prepared. For that, I think India is well equipped. We could see that once again. And then, of course, it is a good thing that there are so many decision makers coming from all over the world to India, because people have to get acquainted with the country, with its cultural specifics, with its, with its whole package, not just, you know, to stay for a few days, but to learn more about history, about the background, about the whole of it, and not just little bit of it. And I myself have been very, very in a very lucky position because I've always been interested in India. So my journey has been going for the last at least 25 years. And now it's kind of a new phase because, to be honest with you, there has been a period in Europe where this interest, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, this interest has been lacking. You know, there have been no demand for experts on India or for connectors between India and Europe. And this is now re-emerging, which is a great, once again, a great reason to be alive. These are, in my view, the most exciting times to be alive.
All right. I can think of 100 more questions I can ask you, but I'm going to end it over here because we are reaching the 1-hour, 30-minute limit. So, Vilina, thank you very much for a very interesting, fascinating, wide-ranging conversation. And I look forward to, in the future, having you again on the podcast. So, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Abhijit. Next time, you will be my guest again. And as I said, I always keep my promises. So in the conversation, let's say in a year from now, we will also touch upon the issue of the personal meeting as promised. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.